David Marks is a culture critic and author of Ametora, Status and Culture in his latest Blank Space, A Cultural History of the 21st Century. A bit of a depressing, if totally necessary and unputdownable read. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Cool surname, by the way. Do you perhaps know if you're in any way related to the Big Daddy Carl?
I have done thorough genealogical research and I'm absolutely not related.
Okay. Still a cool name. Your book, amazingly written, by the way, is a methodical confirmation of the feeling I believe we all had for quite some time now that pop culture or culture in general has gone to shit and is now in the Lord's year of 2026 just a completely unsalvageable dumpster fire. Now, as an aging millennial myself, I'm obviously not impervious to romanticizing the state of affairs in my youth. The different, you know, subcultures we very seriously participated in, the film releases we were actually dying to see, the music we carefully curated on our little Chinese MP3 players. And so for a long time, it made sense to me that a large part of this kind of longing for the 90s was nothing more than simple nostalgia. Nostalgia that probably every generation has about how they were the last ones that managed to tastefully produce meaning. However, like I said in the beginning, your book gives this simplistic view a bit of a trashing, because in it you analyze the spiral of cultural misery of the last 25 years, going systematically from the indie rock scene in New York in the beginning of the noughties to the incredible rise of the Hak Tua girl just last year. I'm curious though. If you could pick one specific moment when you realize we are now inhabiting this, what you call blank space, a space devoid of any cultural innovation, really, what would it be?
I mean, I want to say that in the early 21st century, I don't think it was immediate that things were going to go this way, right? And even in the 90s, I mean, the 90s were really good from the perspective if you were into indie music or alternative music, that music was on the margins and then it became in the center. And that then indie film went on the margins and became in the center. And things like indie comedy, like I don't know if you've ever seen the show Mr. Show that was on HBO with David Cross and Bob Odenkirk, which was late 90s, that was really incredibly innovative in terms of humor. So it just felt like all these different art forms were kind of progressing. Right.
I was watching the Tom Green show myself. I was a big fan.
Tom Green was in some ways maybe innovative, but basically you got to the 21st century. I don't think it was immediate. I mean, the Strokes felt like, okay, they're doing the 70s sound, but they're kind of putting a new spin on it. Or DFA is, you know, taking old no wave and disco, but it's a new sound. I would say about by 2010 or 11, there were multiple new media pieces, including Simon Riddle's book Retromania, and Kurt Anderson had also done this piece about kind of what was the defining fashion style of the 2000s, and nobody kind of had an idea. It did feel like, okay, the culture is more interested in retro and in redoing things, not really changing the style so much. Something's a little off. It was kind of the feeling with 2010, 2011, but it wasn't a permanent despair. I don't think people were like, well, now it's over. And then as the smartphone showed up, I think there was a lot of optimism for a very long time about what YouTube could be or what blogs could be and how they could lead to this flourishing of niche content. So again, I think there was some optimism there. It's really where you hit about 2016 with the election of Trump and Brexit, that you've had a long enough span where it's like, okay, wow, there really aren't that many new styles. And now all these technological tools that we thought would open things up have brought us Donald Trump and a lot of the commercialized internet content, the YouTubers and influencers and these things that are very, very commercial. And then as we've gone in the last 10 years, it's gotten darker and darker. And I think that's why there was this trend over the last couple of weeks where people were posting photos from 2016, because it really does seem like this last 10 years in particular were bleak, that something kind of ended in 2016. But what I tried to show with the book is that at least these trends didn't just come out of nowhere. I think they started around the turn of the century as a backlash to the 90s in a way, and then they just got worse and worse as time went on because of the specific economic and technological conditions.
I thought you were just going to go with the sinister rise of the hipsters in the early 2000s.
No, I mean, even hipsterism, I mean, it felt, I would say, like, you know, new, but it just, you know, American Apparel and all that, it had its own feel, it had its own sound. Like, that's what you want from a youth culture, where you feel like something is new. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that I loved it, that I was like, wow, hipsters, and what an incredible innovation. And there certainly was a lot of critique at the time, but it did feel like, you know, if 90s had grunge, then the early 2000s had hipsters. I mean, that's, again, that's like the thing that we're looking for in our brains, is some sort of difference that we can mark time with.
Speaking of hipsters, I gotta say, as a former journalist, I already harbored nothing but cold disdain for Vice magazine. And your book did nothing to remedy that. In fact, quite the opposite. They really shine as one of the book's clearest villains, don't they?
Well, so I was in New York when I guess they had moved in 99 to New York, but when I got there in 2001, they were very much central to the downtown scene. And Gavin McInnes, one of the founders, was really the mascot of the brand, and also someone who was showing up in other magazines like Dazed and Confused, and really had these friendships with, whether it's Terry Richardson or Ryan McGinley, some of the big photographers at the time. And so Vice felt very central, and seemed, it wasn't on that kind of trajectory of, we're going to be a $7 billion company or $20 billion company or whatever quite yet. But there was just a sense that it was central. And Gavin was doing things at the time. This infamous interview with New York Observer, where he used all these bigoted terms for minorities, and he was wearing pin badges from Nazi rock bands, et cetera, et cetera. And so there was this sense that he was trying to push the envelope, ironically, with all this right-wing stuff. And then he did an article for the American Conservative, and he interviewed the American Conservative for Vice. So there's this kind of weird right-wing turn going on with Vice very early. And I think that eventually got him pushed out of the magazine. But when he later founded the Proud Boys, it seemed like, okay, that there was something going on there where he had found his transgressive aesthetic in right-wing politics rather than left-wing. And it's not to say that that was what inspired 4chan or what's inspired kind of all the right-wing culture that exists now. It's just that he got to that idea first. And I wanted to make sure that people saw that that had happened in 2001, you know, post 9/11, way before kind of 4chan shows up and comes to the same formula.
Yeah, but there was also this gonzo buzz surrounding their quote-unquote journalism at the beginning, because their writers, yes, were willing to inject themselves with crocodile or something to get $15 for the article. But I clearly remember how I just saw one of the titles one day about a guy who can't stop humping his neighbor's hedge, and thought, this is just fucking stupid now.
Yeah, it was all like that. I mean, it was all counterintuitive, and the articles felt honestly fake to me, like that they described ridiculous situations that didn't exist, or I don't know. But I mean, it made sense as this is the center of youth culture, but that it was very nihilistic and empty. And I think that's another thing that I didn't really think about until I wrote the book, which is, after 9/11, earnest left-wing sentiment became a little bit taboo in the United States. And so I think Vice was kind of the perfect media for that time, because it had a little bit of a right-wing edge, but also because it was very nihilistic, and it didn't try to be particularly liberal or left-wing at a time when you really couldn't be anyway. And so I think there's a link there too.
You just said that it was kind of nihilistic and empty, and you know, I was studying communication studies back home in Slovenia when I still lived there. And I distinctly remember how a professor of culture studies told us that we can't use these kind of loaded terms as like empty culture or nihilistic culture anymore. And you write about this in the book as well. Could you talk about this a little bit, this postmodern take where everything, any sort of like judgment, is suddenly off limits?
So in the late 20th century, I mean, I would say Pierre Bourdieu is kind of the start of this, but there is a lot of postmodern, post-structuralist theory that starts to deconstruct taste as a mechanism of class oppression. So that for a very long time, I mean, this is going to get very nerdy very quickly, but there was basically these ideas of taste that came from Immanuel Kant, that taste was this transcendental thing that was in your brain and had nothing to do with whether you took physical pleasure from it. It was all these kind of conceptual ideas in which beauty was born. And I think what Bourdieu was trying to show was know that there are real life materialistic relations for taste. And so anyone who had studied that or any of the things kind of post a lot of this American sociology post Bourdieu, so if they took any cultural studies or anything, they just would have known this idea that there's something suspicious about high culture, that high culture is an oppressive class mechanism. And so as that happened, there was also at the same time a rise in the 90s of these bands who had a little bit of artistic and intellectual pretension. So let's say Radiohead is the perfect example, becoming quite popular. And so you get to Kid A in the year 2000, and it's this very abstract, almost theoretical album that everybody's calling, you know, the greatest album of the 21st century. And it's still on those lists is definitely as one of them. And so you get this kind of group of people who've been trained, these critics who've been trained to think and be very suspicious of that. And at the same time, the kids who are the people who generally like are the center of youth culture really aren't that interested in Radiohead or any of this 90s stuff. They like Britney Spears and Christina Aguilera and NSYNC and Justin Timberlake and Backstreet Boys and all of this. And so there's a group of critics who in the early 2000s really started rejecting this idea that we needed to have the biases against pop music that we did in the 90s. So when I was growing up, New Kids on the Block, which were kind of the Backstreet Boys of their day, came out, and there was just no taking them seriously at all. There was just junk music for teenage girls, and you know, that wasn't, it was never cool, and there was no kind of even ironic appreciation of it. But by the time Max Martin does I Want It That Way, there's all these music critics going out of the way saying this is the, you know, greatest composition of the 21st century, et cetera, et cetera. So there, it was kind of just that annoying thing that critics do where they're counterintuitive. Like some of that was there, but it had an ideological grounding in this idea that if people like pop music, who are we to take that away from them? And, you know, if we have if there's some kind of pleasure you can take from bodily pleasures, none of these transcendental, overly intellectualized pleasures, like who are we to say that those are wrong? If there's classes of people who can't understand those more intellectual forms of art, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the aesthetics and the fashion pendulum swing from Radiohead to Backstreet Boys just coincided with that ideology. And so then you get the thing that is known as poptimism, which is just a real openness and then almost like a feeling of superiority towards pop music and pop culture, that who are we to say Keeping Up with the Kardashians is not as important as Twin Peaks or Breaking Bad or some prestige TV, that that people love them and we should just appreciate them and think about them. And there's in English, there's a term, reverse snobbery, that you use for when people do this. But yeah, just being like, well, I don't like fancy stuff. I'm like a person, I'm of the people, and I love Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
All right, back to the book. Unlike Vice magazine, Kanye West has sort of like a tragic hero arc from this total genre-bending wizard to defining the sound of a generation and bending fashion and reality TV to his will, to finally his public, it was a Jewish doctor, MAGA-fueled meltdown. Why does he embody the era so well? Do you think since he was so influential as a sort of a generator of culture for so long that he's one of its prime movers, or is he more of a symptom of the system going haywire?
He is both. I mean, I get a lot of feedback from the book where people are like, wow, you really, you actually wrote about Kanye. And I think it's very odd to write about this era and not mention his early work that was was less controversial, maybe even non-controversial. And he has been canceled. I mean, even today he had a full page apology in the Wall Street Journal, I believe. But let's just consider him canceled for the time being. But it doesn't change the fact that he was a prime instigator of something in the book, you know, that I call, omnivorism, in the sense that he was, obviously doing rap, but even when he was doing rap, he was interested in bringing together backpack rap and mainstream rap. He was interested in bringing in the entire history of Black music, from jazz to doo-wop to gospel. He was then interested in he wanted to be the Fiona Apple of rap, so getting Fiona Apple's producer to produce him, bringing in Adam Levine and Maroon 5, you know, whatever, just like looking across all of music and just having no barriers in his head and trying to bring it all together. And then working with Daft Punk and doing kraut rock samples. And I mean, he really embodied just this idea of endless curiosity of music and trying to bring it all together. And then that became an interest in street fashion, which became an interest in designer fashion. And it's just very hard to say that he was not the one to bring the whole hip hop world into designer fashion. And now you can't understand what's going on unless you understand that change. So for a long time, he was the instigator. And so then there's the question of just what happened to him in 2016. And there's obviously the kind of mental health side of this, but I think also he just got to a point, you know, because of his attitude towards the world, which was this incredible sense of entitlement and having a giant chip on his shoulder. He then just proceeded to get angrier and angrier. And then that went into some sort of same kind of Gavin McGinnis zone of I'm going to be right wing and anti-Semitic as the absolute taboo breaking thing. And aren't I more transgressive and cool than anyone else because I'm pro-Trump and no one else is. And so I think there's a way to see it that way, but it also just went far beyond how you would do it in an ironic way. I mean, I think he really, really was in that. And then it just got worse and worse, and he thinks he's playing these big pranks, but they're just kind of, literally beyond the pale for society. I would say, I mean, the thing I do think about him as a symptom or just, you know, a representative person, I think Paris Hilton, Kim, and he and Donald Trump all shared one thing, which is that they figured out the hack to getting attention. So attention is the hardest thing to get in the 21st century. And the hack is if you do something that breaks social norms, there's actually no punishment for breaking social norms, but there's massive reward, which is that everyone has to write about it and think about it. And so when Kanye grabbed the microphone from Taylor Swift, you know, not only did he make Taylor Swift bigger than ever before, but even if people weren't, you know, they weren't going to click the article or watch the segment because they like Kanye and they want to support him. They just want to see like what happened? Why did he do that? What's going on? And so you could keep doing these awful things and you just force everyone to pay attention to you, even if they support you or don't support you. And at the end of the day, that is lucrative and that is winning the media cycle. And so, you know, Trump took this platform and took it to the presidency twice, which is if you just say things that are so far beyond what the social norm is, that everyone has to write about it and you just suck all the oxygen out of the room and you win the news cycle. And then obviously there's a group of people who really respect you for it in the sense of, I like that they go out and say the things that you're not supposed to say. But at the same time, you make it where you're the story and everyone else is the sub story to you. So I think in that sense, Kanye figured that out pretty quickly, or he just lacks the inhibition part of his brain that, I mean, Trump has this too, where he could just win in our society because he doesn't have anything stopping him from breaking norms all the time.
Speaking of the Taylor Swift moment, there's one Kanye paragraph in the book that, despite everything I already know about him, really made me burst out laughing. And that's when after his this I'm gonna let you finish moment, he goes into self-exile to Italy to intern for some designer or something for Fendi for $500 a month, even though he's already a superstar. I mean, say what you will about him now, but at least he took fashion kind of seriously for a little bit, didn't he?
I think he was just making copies or something. But I mean, from, you know, the thing about internships in general, and there's like internships have gotten quite controversial because obviously if you're wealthy, it's easier to take an internship than if you're not. But you're really there just to make connections. And I think Kanye got into that world and Virgil, who was with him, Virgil Abloh, got into that world because they did that internship. They met everybody and they were brought back later to do real work.
So it wasn't like a real internship.
I mean, I think kind of they talk about it as if it was very demeaning in the sense that there was nothing for them to do. But I think just being around, they built up connections that they use later.
Well, it wasn't like Daniel Day-Lewis, who took 2 years off and was making shoes in Italy somewhere in some village or something.
I no, I mean, I think it was. I think they weren't there that long, and I think he flew back to finish his album or something.
Yeah,
So it's not.
okay, makes sense. All right, you write about a distinct moment in 2008 after the Lehman Brothers crash and the whole Occupy Wall Street movement, when it seemed that culture could have gone a different way, but instead it turned even more towards this entrepreneurial self-enrichment as the ultimate artistic value thing. Becoming a billionaire was a sign that you really made it as an artist, and that's why people like Jay-Z and Kylie Jenner and LeBron James are so celebrated within the mainstream today. Why do you think we went that way?
I mean, one thing was that if you looked at the financial crash, for a brief moment, it hurt everybody. And then it really just hurt poor people, and bankers got rich really quickly again. And so there was this idea that there was going to be a massive rethinking of society and culture because everybody, including the bankers, lost all their money. And then as soon as the rich people started making money again, and then the market was going up, it was like, oh, well, we don't have to change anything. So I think the structure of the economy didn't need a change, and that made the culture not need a change. And then at the time, Kanye and Jay-Z did Watch the Throne, which was an entire album about just how rich they are and how great it is to be super rich. And so hip hop wasn't going to get off that vector. And so I think there's a scene that's meaningful that you have Occupy Wall Street. I think Occupy Wall Street had a very clever, very sympathy inducing slogan, which is like, we are the 99%. I think most people agreed with that. It was very smart. I think that Occupy itself, with the drum circles and the weird anarchist leadership structure, et cetera, wasn't necessarily winning over normal Americans. But Russell Simmons, the hip hop mogul, for some reason went every day. He was a real supporter of it, and he tried to get the rappers to go. And Kanye, he dragged Kanye there, but Kanye refused to say anything because he didn't want to say any kind of give his statements of support. And then Jay-Z famously made Rock-A-Wear t-shirts that said Occupy All Streets. And then when asked, would you give that money to the Occupy Wall Streets protesters, he said, why would I do that? And then kind of created a distance and said, if they're against entrepreneurism, then I'm against them. So that was a pretty kind of scandalous moment, but it was a real break that the culture was, that hip hop was the culture, that hip hop was still fascinated, and really it staked itself to making money as kind of the ultimate marker of success. And I mean, Jay-Z, I think, was a huge part of that. And then Occupy Wall Street just kind of got dwarfed by that. So it just never caught fire in the popular culture, because the leaders of the popular culture weren't really syncing with it in a way that, I mean, I think Woodstock or the 60s counterculture is slightly different, but at the time, I mean, you look at the Beatles and then you look at how they look in 1969, like obviously they're getting kind of sucked into countercultural ethics and aesthetics. And so, that did not happen, where there was a counterculture and then it kind of flipped everybody.
Please allow me to read this perfect encapsulation of what we were just talking about, this turn of the culture, where it all went. This is just such a fantastic passage from the book. On the July 31, 2011 episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians, Kim Kloe and Kourtney Kardashian, along with Kendall and Kylie Jenner, pressured matriarch Kris Jenner to address her light bladder leakage. You can't be. Excuse me. You can't be at a black tie event and peeing on yourself, Khloé scolded. After receiving a diagnosis of stress incontinence, Jenner didn't just seek medical treatment. She contacted the Kimberly-Clark Corporation, pitching herself as an influencer for Poise, the leading brand in absorbent protection products. Her philosophy was consistent: let's not make it a problem, let's make money. I mean, mic drop. That's all we really need to know about the whole thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but I think that at the time, that show was seen as bottom feeding, to use the term that Trump used to use about reality TV. But there was a sense that it was the worst of the worst, and everybody hated them. And I think post Kim on the cover of Vogue, which I dedicate more or less an entire chapter to because I think it's that big of a deal, there's been a re a kind of reevaluation of Keeping Up with the Kardashians. And now it seemed like, well, there are people who understand the time and they're hustlers and entrepreneurs. And again, who are we to criticize the Kardashians? So this, I guess it's indicative of that value shift, which is they came out and were ridiculed for this kind of behavior, but then it's really hard to look now and say, what did they not get from engaging in that behavior? So of course, at that moment, they made money from Kimberly Clark Corporation or whatever, but you know, Kris Jenner is showing up at the Met Gala not so many years later, and Kim now, I mean, Skims is worth billions of dollars. She can go out and say that the moon landing is a hoax, and still the next day everyone reports on her brand being, you know, this billion-dollar brand. So it's really hard to look at how they didn't win by doing exactly what they did. But it's also because critics softened up and there was a real acceptance of the Kardashian clan. Also, it helps that the Jenner children went on, you know, one of them to become one of the biggest models in the world, and another kind of her own entrepreneur. So they've kind of won the century. And so we can think it's ridiculous, but who's laughing now?
Yeah, not me. Since I'm like, when it comes to fashion, I'm basically illiterate. So why was Kanye and Kim being on the cover of Vogue such a big deal?
First, Vogue and Vanity Fair both had more or less a ban in place on the Kardashians. I think Vanity Fair's was maybe a little stricter, but there was generally a sense that we're not going to put reality TV stars and gossip queens on the cover. And there's a sense that Vogue was the center of high, you know, designer fashion, but, you know, high good taste. And that if an advertiser was putting something in the magazine, it had Anna Wintour's seal of approval, that she really made sure that the whole magazine was good and legitimate and reflected the world's best taste. And so there, from that perspective, you putting a Kardashian on the cover was quite controversial. And there's kind of multiple theories about why it happened when it did. I really believe that Kanye, because he was so tied up with designer fashion and they were married, and he had completely changed her style and updated it and was removing a lot of the barriers towards why you would not have Kim Kardashian on the cover. And then really talking in Anna Wintour's ear all the time about how she needed to be on the cover. And they ended up, you know, being on the cover together, which I think is important. It wasn't just Kim. There's also people who say at some point Anna Wintour realized that the culture had moved away from being, you know, in her words, tasteful, and they had to put whoever was popular on the cover. But the point was that there was a dam. The floodwaters were this hyper-capitalist reality culture, and there was a dam in the Condé Nast publications that were still arbiters of taste, and some point that dam broke. And I think you can look at the Kanye and Kim on that cover as the exact moment when the dam broke, and you can never go back again.
You already mentioned this, but besides pop culture kind of going down the drain, there's another pretty depressing current happening at the same time, and that's the internet disintegrating from a kind of a hopeful and democratic techno-utopian place full of delightful niche projects to this horrific platform AI slop-driven economy, where we now have the cringiest, most socially awkward evil dorks shaping our culture much more than any artist possibly can. I mean, how does Mark Zuckerberg actually have fans? I need an explanation, because I think I'm going crazy here.
I don't know. I don't know if he has fans, to be honest. I mean, I think he doesn't need fans. He just needs users. I mean, I think
Elon Musk or Sam Altman. I mean,
well, I mean, Elon Musk most certainly has fans. Yeah. But I think if you look at Facebook, it's a perfect example of how this all works, which is at some point Facebook was, you know, a site for elite college students, and then only young people really. and then it was for kind of everyone, and then it was for everyone's parents, and then it was only for really media illiterate grandparents, and now it's only for people who can't tell the difference between AI and not AI, and it's mostly AI slop, and somehow this company still exists and people still buy ads on it, and he still makes billions of dollars from this website that we all know is dead and fake. And so it doesn't matter to Mark Zuckerberg what's on Facebook. And the model, and I mean, I wouldn't say this is in his defense, but just the model of these platforms was that you're aggregating, you're only making money through aggregation. You're not making money through what a magazine used to do, which is say, hey, brand, I'm going to make some really cool content and you're just going to pay me to make it look cool and get it in front of cool people. And I can't really give you metrics on that. I mean, it's all kind of imaginary. I can give you fake numbers if you want, but you're just going to feel good that you're in this cool magazine. And same with a, you know, TV show. But when it came to the internet, because it was all precise, but also because you could target these micro advertisers. So, you know, famously the first company to ever buy AdWords on Google sold lobsters, right? So these kind of mid-sized small companies and a lot of scam companies, and a lot of kind of gray market companies. And so you make all your money from aggregating these low rent advertisers, and all they want is just eyeballs. They don't really care about branding or anything. And so the whole ecosystem just takes things away from the idea of taste or of curation or of caring about what's on the platform. The way to make money is to aggregate the worst users and the worst content. And that's why it's gone that direction. And there was some point, even when YouTube was experimenting with curation, they kind of had a page, I think, where they picked cool videos, and it just didn't mean anything. I mean, I think people were still going towards more viral moments or the early YouTube partner program people. And at some point, YouTube had given all this money to fancy creators to make fancy content. And then what happened was they all got outpaced by the YouTube native people. And so, you know, the platforms are really, the more they get out of the way of curation, the more money they've made. So the lesson they learned is just let you know, whatever works work. And if that's AI slop, then that's AI slop. They're completely uncultural people and completely agnostic to what's on their platform. So of course this happened.
What do you think, like, stuff that is curated online doesn't stick or doesn't reach a broader audience?
I mean, some of it does. I mean, I think there's still some people who are kind of famous for being good aggregators. And, you know, a lot of newsletters these days, I say, are very good at that, which is if you're interested in men's fashion or something and you read Blackbird Spy Plane, here's some brands you should know, here's some items you should know, etc. So I think that's going on a little bit in the elite media sphere. It's just that making money on the internet, again, making huge sums requires huge scale, and huge scale just means you're not curating for taste. You have to curate for attention, and that means lowest common denominator. And so, I mean, one of the most horrifying experiences on the internet is if you open TikTok and you haven't really registered yet, you just like, welcome to TikTok. Oh, you're a 40 something male. And then the videos it shows you are just like beyond reproach. I mean, it's the most softcore girls jiggling, you know, without bras. And you're just,
I can confirm.
Like, okay. And you're like, okay, not that. Like, can I just see something in my interest? But I mean, you'd have to work so hard for it to not share you the worst videos on the platform. But it just says, oh, okay, well, these are the videos that are popular. And so here you go. And so it's that mindset of we're going to send you the slop that all these other idiots like, because who cares? I mean, that's the way the internet makes money. And so if you do curation, you're just already you're trying not to be to scale things. But the economy of the internet so far has been about scale. It just, that's the way you make money, is more.
Yeah. In the podcast space, which is already not, it's already a bit of a bit bro-y, and like even my clips, and I really try have really smart people on, But the clips that are doing the best are like the most quote unquote controversial ones, you know. Anything else just doesn't, people just not interested. So it's a bit dispiriting that way.
Yeah, there's also a ton of these reels or TikToks that look like they're podcasts and they're not even podcasts. They're just fake podcast clips from people trying to get famous saying ridiculous things. And then you're like, what podcast would they have said this on? It's like, it's not even a podcast. I mean, the whole, you know, yeah, the whole ecosystem is rotten. And I guess the thing that, it's in some ways, if you go back to the 80s or 90s and you turned on TV, if you were a kid trying to watch TV in the United States on a Saturday night, it was grim. I mean, there was nothing on the TV that you would want to watch. So it's not that, you know, all of culture used to be great and now all of culture is terrible. That you could draw a parallel to the terrible things that used to be on TV, and then the mainstream culture now is, it's a little bit less ethical, less polished, much more toxic, but it's still low quality. The difference was that in the 80s or 90s, you had these alternative channels, like an indie film cinema or something, in which young people anchored their identity to, I don't watch TV, I go to this other thing. I don't listen to pop radio, I go to this cool, you know, punk club or something, right? And so the problem now is that everything is on these platforms. They were all on Instagram, we're all on YouTube, everything's from a search in Google, whatever it is. And so you get this feeling that you can't escape the mainstream in a way that people just fully reject it. And so I think that's one of the tasks of our era, which is that can we find routines? If you're not into this stuff, if you're listening and you love a TikTok that doesn't even match your algorithm, it just gives you the worst things on the internet, then you're doing great and you don't need my help. But if you're somebody who doesn't like this and wants to go back and connect with people who have different tastes and really get into that world, there just has to not only be places for you to hang out that are separate, and that could be a Discord channel, I mean, it could be a separate internet space, but you have to start feeling good that you're in this good space and you hate the other ones. There has to be some sort of antipathy of what you're doing and a real rejection of the other one. You can't feel like, I'm in a Discord channel, but I understand that all the cool kids or the best stuff is somewhere else. And so I think that's the big difference, is that we just don't have a way to think about our niche internet behavior as being anything other than loser behavior.
Which brings us to the concept of omnivore monoculture. What is that?
Okay, so omnivorism is this idea that starts, it's a term that comes out of sociology in the 90s, but more or less it used to be that wealthy people consumed high culture and upper middle class people consumed middle brow culture, and everyone else can consume low brow culture or these kind of ethnic subcultures. And the idea of omnivorism was that upper middle class consumers and wealthy people started consuming all things, and it became a little bit snobby to only like high culture. And so, you know, if you watch a show like The Simpsons, it's all written by these Harvard graduates, and it has jokes in which the father strangles his child. It has like really stupid physical gags, but it also makes references to Wittgenstein and, gets on Lisa's case for breaking the laws of physics and bashing the very elite school Vassar, et cetera, et cetera. So you get these cosmopolitan liberal people want to consume high and low. And so that's called omnivorism, because it's like eating, you know, meat and vegetables. You're eating, you're consuming high and low culture from around the world. At some point that, you know, became its own little world, and it grows and grows and grows where different things go in. And as I was talking about earlier with the cover for Vogue that has Kanye, a hip hop star, Kim, a reality TV star, now in this design world, you know, that becomes part of that omnivore monoculture too. And so now you have almost everything in there. And the only thing that really wasn't in there for a long time was country music. So hip hop had absorbed everything else. And then you get to Lil Nas X and Old Town Road, and suddenly you've got a hip hop country crossover. And now you've got Shaboozy, I guess that was last year, 2 years ago now, with Tipsy. And so you know, it's just now it's normal that hip hop and country are unified. So you have this monoculture in the sense of globally, everybody's kind of consuming the same things, but it can be anything. So that's different from a monoculture from the 50s or something where everything had to be the same. So it's not that everything has to be the same. You can bring in all these different references. You can have Bad Bunny from Puerto Rico. You can have, you know, people from Europe participating. You can have K-pop. You can have labubus that are from a Hong Kong designer made by a Chinese company, etc. You can have that in the monoculture, but it still feels like everywhere you go, you're going to, everything's going to kind of sound the same and feel the same, and everyone's going to have the same references. And so it's this globalized stew, but the stew kind of has the same flavor everywhere you go. And I mean, one example of this is that it doesn't matter what kind of music you listen to, more or less, I mean, any kind of new popular music from around the world will have some sort of drums that are from trap music. The trap drums are now kind of the template for what drums sound like. And so it's things like that. It's just that, you know, you can add Bollywood, Indian instrumentation on top of it, but there has to be trap drums. And same with, you know, K-pop, you can have this kind of specific Korean sound, but it has to have flourishes like American electronic music. And so so we're just in this omnivore monoculture, and because anything can go, it's kind of hard to create an alternative to it, because you can't say, well, you guys don't like this thing, so I have to do it over here. Because in theory, the omnivore monoculture can absorb everything. So in some ways, if you're into something and it's not being absorbed, it means it must be bad. And so I think it actually is more powerful in a way than the original monoculture, because it's very hard to resist.
Yeah, and it like you're right, it extends to spaces and even faces to a certain degree, right? I moved to Tokyo from Berlin, but at a certain point, I realized that all the cafes that were opening, all the new cafes, had the same look all of a sudden. You know, this kind of minimalistic white walls, kind of barren yes. looking, yeah, minimalism, whatever. And it's like, what are we doing here?
And they all have basically the same menu yeah. and the same feature totally. Blender or, you know, yeah. Grinder, sorry, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, and then Gia Tolentino has this idea of Instagram face, that there was actually, through plastic surgery, women were kind of all getting the same face. And in that article, it talked about how 80%, I think something like 80% of the women brought in a photo of Kim Kardashian or someone who looked like Kim Kardashian and wanted to look like her. So it really is also a monoculture of looks and aesthetics that goes from the human body to the architecture and design.
Taylor Swift, another billionaire, by the way, is a perfect kind of representative of the ultimate triumph of what you call poptimism. I don't think, I don't know if that's your term. In the last, 15, 20 years, she just seems completely indestructible. Sometimes I feel like she's going to be everywhere I look until I croak or something, like some sort of a medieval monarch. Why is that? Why is she so successful?
I mean, so some of it is she does really connect with a huge group of people, mostly women. I mean, it's very gender stratified, her fan base. We live in a world in which I used to call this, we used to have kind of a mass majority, you know, so if you have mass culture, you had everybody in that majority all liked something. Now it's really like a mass plurality, where I don't know if even most people like Taylor Swift, but if you're going to have a group of people like an artist, she has the largest group behind her. So she's just the most reliable and can activate her fans the most. And so she is very smart about how to monetize that and how to run her career. And her music is engineered to be very pleasant for the people who buy it. I don't think that she's artistically, there's nothing offensive about the music she makes. I think it's just the offensiveness is more.
That's a nice way
of
putting it. Yes.
Yeah. It's just that the offensiveness is that it doesn't seem to take many risks, and it seems to often be based off of formulas that already exist rather than creating new ones, which is something I would not say about Beyonce. I think Beyonce takes a lot of risks and has a lot of music that sounds very new. And so she's just really good at what she does. But I mean, it was interesting because this last album, kind of showed how strong she is in the sense that even her fans were a little mixed on it and didn't like the lyrics in particular. But the New York Times gave it glowing reviews. And so there was a disconnect where it seemed like a lot of the top critics could not find a single fault with it, even though the fans could find a fault with it. And because the fans could find some fault with it, it opened the door for some critics who I think had shut their mouth for a long time because they were scared of the fans to start saying, yeah, maybe this isn't actually that good.
Scared of Swifties, not the most gangster demographic.
Yeah, but. I mean, I had a channel called Swiftologist, say how much he hated my book. And I was like, okay, here it comes. And I got one DM on Instagram that was like, Taylor Swift is going to kill you. I was like, uh-oh. But the flood never came. So it was an empty mess. If you're a Swiftie and hearing this, please
don't try
to attack me. Yeah.
All right, David, why do you reckon that nothing really sticks anymore? For example, I'm a pretty massive TV nerd. I studied screenwriting. I still watch all the shows that need to be watched, but good, even fantastic as they might be, they just don't have the same impact as shows from the past did. I mean, I just watched the second season of Severance recently, and it did have a considerable amount of buzz. On the other hand, The Sopranos, something that was made a quarter of a century ago, has an entire ecosystem that's still very much alive out there. I mean, there's Reddit, there's meme accounts on Instagram, there's new books and podcasts and documentaries all dedicated to a show that stopped airing in 2007. What's going on there?
I mean, another example is Nathan Fielder's The Rehearsal, which I thought got really good reviews and people were very excited about it, but after it aired, I've heard almost no people talk about it. And when I bring it up, it's like, I think it's one of the great things of the 21st century, an example of where you can take a format like reality TV and do something interesting with it. People are like, oh yeah, that was great. they had completely forgotten about it. I think that one part of this is the degree to which viewing is now completely voluntary. And I was just, I've been talking to a friend about, we just kind of like to nostalgia each other. Like, did you watch Adventures of Pete and Pete, or did you see Erie, Indiana, or whatever? But, you know, today I was like, did you watch The Facts of Life? And the thing about The Facts of Life, which is this 80s sitcom, which wasn't good. I don't remember because it's good. You remember because it was on. You know, you just watched so much TV because you passively had nothing else to do but flip the channels and watch something. And so I think that created obviously communal culture, but just more repetition in your brain. And so much of lasting memory and the power of something to take on what in my second book, Status and Culture, I talk about this more, but this idea of historical value, that we care about it as something we want to take with us that's in the canon. I think you have to have that repetition. And so it can't just be like, it comes out, everybody watches it and they move on. They don't think about it again. It has to be something where you go back and watch it all the time. And, you know, when I was, even in the 90s, I would tape every episode of The Simpsons. And then when I was bored, I would just rewatch these like 10 video cassettes of, you know, every Simpsons, or Twin Peaks. I had, you know, video cassettes of all of them. And so it wasn't just that I watched Twin Peaks once. It was that I watched Twin Peaks like, you know, five times or six times before I graduated from high school. And you'd watch the same movie over and over again. And so that repetition is key. So I think Sopranos is one of those that reached that. And then obviously with memes and with just the fact that the show was so iconic and they created these characters that didn't exist before and these kind of catchphrases, that all helps. You know, even a movie like Mean Girls, I think it is in the canon, right? People go back to it and reference it, and it launched the careers of a bunch of people. So it doesn't even have to be necessarily that it's quality. It's just, I think it has to be some sort of repetition, and Severance didn't have that. And it also ultimately attracts a kind of person who watches things and then moves on to whatever the new buzzy thing is, rather than some sort of really loyal person who wants to watch it over and over again. And honestly, I mean, I've only seen a bit of Severance, but in most of these shows, I don't want to watch over and over again. I can't imagine going back in watching even the shows I liked.
Right. Yeah, that does resonate. I never thought of that, but it makes sense. Like in the 90s in Slovenia, we had a whole host of like kind of B TV shows like Renegade or MacGyver, you know, that we would watch over and over again. That's how we learned English. And I still have a soft, even though they weren't good shows, I still have a soft spot for them, you know. And Severance, like you said, I'm never going to watch again. It was a good show, but I'm never going to watch it.
Yeah, but I mean, we just don't anymore. If you're not watching linear TV, like the chance of you saying, I'm just going to watch this really less than mediocre show that I don't care about. Why would you do that? Like, you would just watch. There's so much content that you could like. And so, yeah, my entire childhood. I mean, Golden Girls was a show about four elderly women that I watched all the time because there was nothing else on TV. And every time I watched it, I did not enjoy it. But I know the theme song by heart. So it's just there's no experience like that. Or I mean, even more than that, when Nickelodeon started, they didn't have enough children's programming to be an entire day. And so at night they did Nick at Night, which was just 50s TV show reruns.
And was that so TNT?
No, this is pre-TNT. And so right. I watched so much Leave It to Beaver and Dennis the Menace, My Three Sons, Donna Reed Show. I mean, all of these old black and white sitcoms, I mean, family dramas, whatever. I don't even know if they're sitcoms, which I have no interest in, but I like understood the world so much more than I think a kid today would, because I had was forced myself to watch these shows. And just nobody today would ever go back and watch Family Ties or, you know, any of these, just the same kind of shows from the 80s. It just, you don't have the opportunity to do so.
The defining ethos of pop culture in the 90s was pretty simple. Don't sell out. You write how Pearl Jam, one of the biggest bands on the planet at that time, actually began to refuse to film music videos and stop doing interviews because they were becoming too popular for their comfort. I mean, that's the complete opposite of what we have now, when people do the craziest shit to get noticed on TikTok for 15 seconds. Do you think we could ever bring this attitude back?
I think it's already happening in certain ways. Pitchfork, I believe the last two album of the years are not on Spotify. So that seems like a very interesting thing, where musicians are realizing the less accessible they make their music, the more valuable it is.
But are people still reading Pitchfork? Do they have an impact?
No, but I think Pitchfork, it's not necessarily that Pitchfork was the only one who appreciated these albums. I think it was just a sign of these are albums that people care about.
Right.
So I do think that there is a sense of, there's two parts of selling out. There was the part of, we don't want to make our art look commercial. I think it's very difficult right now. And it seems very pretentious to be doing something where you're like, we don't care about the money, we're just doing it. Nobody really buys it. But then there's another part, which was, by making a music video, you put your music in front of every teenager in America, rather than specific people who really cared about it or had an alternative radio station. And so you were limiting distribution. The Pearl Jam was saying, we don't want to be in front of everybody, we only want to be in front of these specific people who really care. And that is something that is possible, I think people are starting to do. And so there was an article, it felt tongue-in-cheek, but I think there was kind of a point to it that Kyle Chayka did in The New Yorker a couple months ago, that was saying low follower counts on social media platforms is cool. It's like cooler to have a low follower count than a high follower count. And I think it says something, which is just that if you're somebody who's in the know, but you're really bad at social media, you may actually have very few followers. And if you're someone who's really good at making viral video, but you don't know anybody, you may have like millions of followers. And so people are starting to read these numbers and notice that to get to a million, you have to go far beyond just being a popular person. You have to be someone, either you're massively popular in the pop culture and people are following you, but in most cases, if it's somebody I've never heard of and they have a million followers, it just means they're really, really good at making online content. And that is not a high status activity. And so I think there's a sense that being a little more scarce and just connecting with your group and being hard to get I mean, in fashion, it's everything, but I think in pop culture, it's starting to become a way too. So I don't know if completely not selling out or not seeming like you're commercial, there's no value. There's no like ideology that like, I think it matches to at the moment, but I think certainly limiting your distribution is something that's gonna happen more.
There's a hopeful note at the end of Blank Space where you say that just a small vanguard of artists can potentially turn around the value system within the space of cultural production. However, I have to say I'm a bit of a pessimist here, because if I look at who's creating art these days, who's being creative, it's usually either Nepo babies or trust fund kids with rich parents. The rest of us are too busy trying to afford groceries. So it does look pretty grim out there at the moment.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this was a hard book to do in the sense that I spend 300 pages outlining these massive structural reasons why everything has turned out the way it is. And at the end to say, okay, here's like 5 easy tips that you can do at home to fix everything. So I don't want to be naive about the challenges. And, you know, Nepo babies and rich kids and people who've mastered the algorithm, they all have an advantage over everyone else. I'm not going to take that away. I would say, however, that if people get together with this mindset, and it really does have to be collective, it can't just be one person fighting the system. If you have everybody with the mindset that there's something rotten about these central platforms and a rejection of the people who are trying to be big on them and movement to something else and a real support of that community, I think that it could just organically move attention away and make it seem less cool. And it's already happening. I mean, just if you go to Instagram compared to 5 years ago or 6 years ago, 6 years ago, your Instagram was you watching stories from everyone you know. And because of that, everyone was posting stories. And so you got to see everyone's lives and you could kind of catch up with them. I would say now it's in my case, I would say only 25% of the people I know are really posting. And then the platform itself is sending me just movie clips or, you know, reels. I mean, it's just the experience is completely different. And so the platform itself has already had to adapt from the fact that people are just not volunteering all this content to it the way that they used to. They're moving away. That people are moving away from the platforms and living life somewhere else that's maybe not for the screen. And so the problem is, everyone's moving away, but they just consider their life away from Instagram to be lesser than the life that they're living online or something. And that's the crazy part. And that's what you have to have the mindset flip about, is that no. When we're off of the platform and having fun and doing things and making things, that is where the real culture is. And this other thing is actually the fake culture. So when the internet started, that's what it was like, because the internet was so pathetic. And just that it was mostly text and really ugly. And so you would have some sort of fake representation of reality on the internet. People talking about, oh, we went to a show last night and this, it was cool. But it didn't replace the show itself. But at some point in the 2010s, the internet replaced real life as society. And so I think we have to, if we're going to abandon the internet and go back to like having real life society, we just have to start feeling like that is real life and that's where it's happening. And I think that's the thing that would kickstart, I think, our ability to fight back against where we are now.
Yeah. I mean, even when we have real life fun, now we have this kind of impulse, this diktat in our mind that we need to record that we're having fun and we need to blast it out on social media. Otherwise, people will think we're not having fun and we're living lame lives. That's the really hard bit, because I recognize it within myself. You know, like I'm having fun and I'm like, whoa, I need to record this. People need to know that I have a cool life. It's like, what? It's depressing.
Or even...
I'm sorry.
I mean, I would say in most cases... that is true. I would say there's also more a naive or simple thing, which is just that, like, I was on a plane. I just went to Paris. On the way there, I flew Finnair and I flew over the North Pole. And at some point they said, hey, you can see the aurora the Northern Lights if you look out the window. And so I looked out the window and it's incredible. But then instantly it's like, I got to get a photo of this.
Of course.
And it's not just like to post to be like, look how cool I am that I saw the aurora. But it's, you know, I want to capture this and I want to show it to my friends to be like, it was really cool. I was on a plane. I saw aurora. So just the fact that we have this tool that lets us permanently capture things, it's really tempting. It's just, it's a lot to ask to say, I'm going to go somewhere and see something incredible and I'm not going to take it with me forever.
Well, David, thank you so much for your time. The book is fantastic. I recommend everybody get it and read it. Find bookstores everywhere, I suppose.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a little bit hard to get outside of the US, but I know they started distributing it to the UK, and you may have to order it from the US, but it's out there.
Yeah, I downloaded it on Amazon. You can get like a Kindle version.
That's very easy.
Also, yeah. I went to the biggest English bookshop in Tokyo here, and they had it as well. Kinokuniya.
Oh, they did. Okay.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, Kinokuniya. Yeah, exactly. In Shinjuku. Yeah.
Oh, good. So, good. Okay.
Yeah, that was cool. All right, David. Thanks, Emil.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for listening. Please subscribe to the podcast on YouTube, follow and rate on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Otherwise, I will just fade into obscurity forever. Also, feel free to support me on Patreon. This is a one-person podcast. I do everything by my little old self. You'd be surprised at how much work gets poured into this, especially with no team and coupled with my stubbornness when it comes to reading stupid ads, which I refuse to do. But you can help by hopping on Patreon and finding the Smart Cookies podcast on there and giving me your money, of course. And then last but certainly not least, I have to thank my existing patrons, Tovarishin, Tovarishitsa. Like always, without you, there is no Smart Cookies podcast, which makes you not just absolute legends, but also producers of this show. So eternal thanks goes to Bash Machkin, Simon Widmar, Luke Johnson, Jim Bird, Bewildered Beauty, Davorin Paulica, Dale and Mia, Chert Gosar, Sasha Sodia, Amy Ons, Mattia Rinchel, Florian Hawa, Peter Karba, Matija Supančić, Dejanžo Lirderej, Roktažan, Saša Vipotnik, Nemec Vjanović, Juš Premrov, Sirkezi, Goran Ivašić, Anže Sever, Ole, Marin Ferrara, Aljaš Mahar, Štrole, Ajda Mancijan, Miha Medved, Medinjo, Goran, Gordon Lorenzo, Jurečuk, Mila, Carmen Veronica, and Taichi. Oof, the list is getting longer, which makes me super grateful. Thanks again, everybody. Means a lot.